Namo Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Prachadane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschacadisha Tadane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shwasti Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Read from Srimad Bhagavatam, count of 10, chapter 70, verse 29. Tano Bhavan Pranata Shoka Har Angra Yugmo. Badan Vi Yungsva Magad Av. Vaya karma pasat. Yo bubu joyuta matangaja viryam eko. Bibra roda bhavane mrigal radi vavi. Pranata, of those who have surrendered, shoka, sorrow, hara, which remove, angri, of feet, yugma, whose pair, badan, bound, viyungsva, please release, magada avaya, going by the name Maghara, karma, a fruit of work, pashat, from the fetters, ya, who, bubuja, kings, ayuta, 10,000, matam, maddened, gadja, of elephants, viryam, prowess, Eka, alone, Bibrat, wielding, Ruroda, imprisoned, Bhavane, in his residence, Mrigarat, the lion, Eva, just as, Avi, sheep. Translation, therefore, since your feet relieve the sorrow of those who who surrender to them, please release us prisoners from the shackles of karma manifest as the king of Magadha. Wielding alone the prowess of 10,000 maddened elephants, he has locked us up in his house just as a lion captures sheep. Purport, the kings here pray for the Lord to release them from the bondage of karma created by the Lord's immaterial potency. The kings make it clear that Jarasandha is so powerful that there's no hope for them to escape by their own power. So this is a conclusion of a prayer by the kings imprisoned by Jarasandha. At the same time as being a prayer, and it's also a request. Usually we have devotees making prayers, and they have a specific request sometimes. Of course, we also know that generally we shouldn't ask for anything from the Supreme Lord, because our bhakti should be without, you know, material motivation or desire for liberation. We see that devotees sometimes do pray for something. Of course, many devotees are very intelligent and devotional, and therefore they simply pray to the Lord for a good bhakti or for getting the mercy of the Lord, etc., which is very fine for us. In other words, though we are not to ask for anything, the devotees do have desires, and our desire is to somehow please Krishna. So the stronger that desire is, the stronger Krishna is pleased. So we don't give up desire, so we can manifest that desire in requests for service or whatnot, rather than for material acquisition. So if it's not particularly for our own material benefit or even benefit of liberation, then it is not only permissible, but actually it is praiseworthy. Here the kings, of course, have a specific request, which is, we can say, materially contaminated in one sense, because they please release us from this prison. But on the other hand, it's a little more, philosophically shaded, because they also talk about the bondage of karma, that you should release us from the bondage of karma. They realize that their imprisonment is also part of their own karma, and that they have created this situation for themselves due to the their activities in the past and whatever. So whatever suffering they've created for other living entities is reflected in their own situation now, where they're in prison. They do have some sort of philosophical realization at the same time. And not only they understand that their action or their circumstance now is due to karma, they also realize that the only solution is to surrender to the Supreme Lord, which is also very positive. Of course, we also know that people who surrender because of their suffering condition are a type of mixed devotees. We have the arta-arti, the arta-arti and the arta-arti. They have material desires. Either they're suffering or they desire arta, material benefits, and they're asking for something. So these are called mixed devotees because their devotion is tinged with desires to get something from the Lord. On the other hand, we know that most people will approach the Lord in the beginning because they do have some problem in this world. They're not so happy with the material condition. They want a better condition. So this is often a common approach to the Supreme Lord, and the Lord accepts that also. But we have these classifications of mixed bhakti and pure bhakti because we should progress beyond the mixed type of bhakti and come to that pure level eventually. And when we come to that pure level, then our advancement towards bhava and prema is quicker. So here we find their circumstance of suffering in the prison motivates them to surrender to Supreme Lord after realizing that karma is insurmountable. So it's also, we can say, a correct conclusion.
We cannot destroy a karma by effort on our own. Now, we do have other methods like jnana and yoga. Eventually, they do destroy karma because they give liberation. However, if we examine closely, we can understand that even the jnana and the karma don't really give liberation. They help, definitely. But the ultimate key for liberation for the jnani and yogi is mercy of the Lord also. And if they don't get that mercy, no liberation. So in other words, Supreme Lord is the giver of liberation, not your own effort. So even if they desire that impersonal liberation, they have to get the mercy of the Lord for that. Therefore, it's described that jnana, which offends the Lord, is useless. One cannot get liberation with that. One will fall from one's position. So the jnana must be mixed with some degree of bhakti. However, the Lord is quite merciful, and he doesn't demand you have to surrender completely to me. It's just to get liberation in Brahman, because otherwise they wouldn't even be, jnanis at all. They would be devotees in that case, and they wouldn't want liberation. They have to have an acceptance of the Lord and some recognition of the Lord's power for giving liberation and respect the Lord properly. Then the Lord gives them that liberation after all their hard endeavor and their offering respect to him. He gives them liberation, which is, we can say, a little bit peculiar, because if they surrender to the Lord to get liberation, why don't they just simply surrender to the Lord and go to the spiritual world? Because they've been cultivating this desire for liberation, and that's what they want. The Lord gives it to them. Therefore, even karma and jnana are ultimately dependent upon mercy of the Lord and bhakti. Yes, karma. To destroy that karma, then ultimately, and get liberation, of course, we can say the destruction of karma completely means liberation. So to destroy all that karma, then definitely the Lord must give his mercy for that, whether it's through jnana or yoga, or through bhakti. In any case, mercy of the Lord is necessary. Material endeavors cannot produce an end to karma. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, mama maya duratyaya, difficult, impossible to get over my bondage of karma. Maya is very, very difficult to surpass. Definitely the mercy of the Lord is necessary to get even liberation. Of course, here the immediate problem is for the kings is that they are suffering in the prison. This represents, of course, a bigger situation. The kings also realize that previously they prayed that we wasted our whole lifetime in asking for material things, getting material positions, etc., and we realize all useless. Not only the present situation is a problem, but the whole material world is a problem, and the kings also realize that. However, their immediate request is, please release us from the bondage of this prison. The condition in this case is that the prison is impossible to escape, almost, just like the material world. So it's described here how Jarasandha has imprisoned them in such a way that they can't get out. He has the prowess of 10,000 Madan elephants. So impossible for a normal person to combat that. Who can combat the power of Jarasandha ultimately? Supreme Lord. He is the one who can do that. Of course, we see that ultimately, sometimes he doesn't act directly, he does it through his devotees. So that's also there. But nevertheless, even they get their shakti ultimately from Supreme Lord. So the Supreme Lord becomes the ultimate doer of all of these activities. But he does so through his devotees, and he gives favor and fame to his devotees by these actions. So the kings pray in this way, please release us from this prison, because it's impossible to get out. Just as karma is impossible to escape except by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. So, how do we get the mercy of the Lord? One has to surrender to the Lord, which is represented here by the words pranata, which means to bow down, to give proper respect to the feet of the Lord, which remove all sorrow. Again, this is a negative description of the feet of the Lord. Yes, they remove sorrow. We can get out of the material world and get rid of all of our lamentation and birth and death and karma, etc., by worshiping the Lord, the feet of the Lord. And, of course, people who are suffering, that's what they want. So that's how they'll describe the lotus feet of the Lord, the remover of all suffering. But a more mature devotee will understand that lotus feet of the Lord not only destroy suffering, but they also give the highest bliss. So there is an opposite, a more positive aspect of the lotus feet as well. So they do destroy karma and get rid of suffering, but if one surrenders to the lotus feet of the Lord, one develops prema, and then rasa, and then bliss. Therefore, here we get a little bit of a lesser realization of the powers of the Supreme Lord, power to remove suffering, and lamentation, etc. So, nothing wrong with that, because, true, the Lord does do that, and the Lord's the only one that can do that, ultimately. So, therefore, for people who are suffering, they're advised, you worship the Supreme Lord, and He will take away all that suffering. We'll find in other places in the Bhagavatam also such statements are made, how the Lord removes suffering, the Lord removes karma, the Lord frees us from the problems of the material world, etc. So such statements are true. They're also, we can say, partial. They don't represent everything about the Supreme Lord's nature and His powers. In fact, not the most important part also. Nevertheless, the people in the material world are attracted to these things, so therefore such descriptions are given. And, of course, the situation here of the kings is such that they want release for their suffering, so they pray in this way. You're the only one that can relieve us from this condition of suffering in this prison, because Jarasandha is an impossible enemy. No one can combat him. So, very appropriately, they pray in this way for release. So surrender to the Lord, of course, implies many things. Even the lotus feet imply many things. We often speak about lotus feet, feet, etc. Why we are talking so obsessed with the Lord's feet, of all things. Because the feet, we can say, are the approach to the Lord. And to go to the feet, then we have to get down on the ground. So that means pranama. We're down on the ground. And that implies complete humility. We accept our position as a small servant of the Supreme Lord. Or as in the Shashastika, Lord Chaitanya says, I just want to be a particle of dust at your lotus feet. So we accept our very small position, and we accept the powerful position of the Supreme, or exalted position of the Supreme Lord. And this is, of course, part of the act of surrender, or Sharanagati, or Sharanapatti. So as mentioned, there are six qualities, such as accepting what is favorable, rejecting what is unfavorable. So one is this feeling of complete smallness, karpanya, that we are most miserable and small and insignificant in front of the Lord. So that's an important element of that surrender. So, therefore, that, and it's also very necessary to to begin the process of bhakti, to have that idea of being very small and insignificant and very humble. And for that reason, of course, Lord Chaitanya says that one should be humbler than the blade of grass, more taller than the tree, and then you can chant the holy name always. So it's like a condition for chanting the holy name, which is the most liberal of all processes. But in any case, for the process of bhakti also, that surrender is and humility is required. And thus, Jiva Goswami Bhaktisandarbha says that this surrender or sharanagati is the first anga of bhakti. Before you do the other angas, you have to surrender. Which sounds a little impossible. How can we surrender? But at least a little bit, just as faith is a qualification. We don't have 100% faith, but we have maybe 0.0001% faith, and that's our qualification for beginning bhakti. So in the same way, we have a little bit of that sharanagati or a surrender in the beginning. As bhakti progresses, that surrender, the faith, and that humility increase. They automatically must do so, because the more that we appreciate and realize the Lord, then and the more our false ego, pride, karma, avidya, ignorance, etc., all get destroyed, then the qualities of bhakti begin to manifest more and more and more, and stronger and stronger. So therefore, it is stated by Sanatana Goswami that ultimately that humility, which he calls dānya, feeling very small and insignificant in front of the Lord, that manifests more strongly in the very advanced devotees. And ultimately, the highest devotees in the spiritual world even, that manifest in higher and higher degrees as the intensity of prema increases, until we get to the gopis, who are the highest of all. And they have the most humility and smallness and whatever. They think themselves the most fallen and unqualified of all. So it's more like we say intrinsic to the whole process of bhakti, and it manifests to the highest degree when we have the highest intensity of bhakti, even the highest intensity of prema, it manifests to the highest degree. So therefore, very rightly we see that it's placed at the very beginning of the whole process of bhakti. It's one of the intrinsic elements that will help it develop, and very necessary for it to develop. So, therefore, surrender is often mentioned. One should surrender to the Lord and lotus feet, etc. So surrendering to the lotus feet or accepting the lotus feet means at least a little bit of that idea of accepting smallness in front of the Supreme Lord. We can't even approach Him higher up, just so we approach the feet of the Lord. But because the Lord is perfect, all of His limbs or angas are perfect. So therefore, you can get complete satisfaction from His feet, even though they're one limb and considered the inferior limb. The head is the top limb and the feet are the bottom limb. But we know that the Lord's limbs are more or less interchangeable and can share the qualities of the other, and they all have perfection, they all have beauty, etc. So therefore, we have elaborate descriptions of the lotus feet of the Lord, how beautiful they are. The soles of the feet, the toes and the toenails, etc. Everything is very beautiful about those feet. They have the color is beautiful, the fragrance is beautiful, wonderful, strong and sweet, etc. So ultimately very attractive. So they represent the Lord also, because they have the sweetness of the Lord. The form or beauty and the fragrance, etc. All very, very attractive, of course, spiritual. So therefore, surrendering to the lotus feet does not limit our bliss, because it ultimately represents the whole Lord, and it contains all of the wonderful qualities of the Supreme Lord. But in any case, as we advance, and then of course we see the whole form of the Lord. It's not that just see the feet all the time. We see the whole form of the Lord. So we find advanced devotees in the rasas, even if they're in Shanta or Dasya. They get to see the whole form of the Lord as well. Surrender is very necessary, and the feeling of smallness is very necessary all through the whole process. So therefore we find an emphasis upon surrendering to the lotus feet of the Lord. And as I said, it can give, it does give, that freedom from lamentation, fear, karma, all that. Just as we find in devotional service, the first character is this klesha guni. Basically, that's this, to destroy all the suffering. And so bhakti does that. And it does it, it starts the process at the very beginning of bhakti. It starts destroying all the karmas and ignorance and desires, and it goes through that process and continues all the way into bhava stage, where finally ahankara is destroyed. And then finally, the last traces of anarthas are dissipated in bhava stage. Definitely it is a part of bhakti. But then the other part of it is subhada. Good qualities also manifest, not just taking away all the bad things of the material world and anarthas, but manifestation of good qualities simultaneously takes place in the process of bhakti. So we should have a balanced view of the Lord and His powers, not just the power to destroy the bad effects on of the material world, but rather the good effects are the qualities that manifest in bhakti, the qualities that are manifested in the Supreme Lord, because He is full of all wonderful qualities. So these will manifest also in the devotee. Naturally, by serving the Lord, we develop similar types of qualities to the Lord. So therefore, all wonderful qualities manifest in the Lord as well. The Lord has many, many qualities, but of course, His ultimate essence is bliss. He is Ananda in His essence. And the Ananda is produced through rasa. So therefore, ultimately, the devotee not only destroys ignorance, but he also gets that quality of Ananda, which is the chief quality of the Supreme Lord. So that develops in the devotee also through rasa again. And that's through the relationship with the Lord. So simultaneously with the destruction of suffering is the increase of that bliss. It does not manifest, of course, when we're doing sadhana. It manifests first in bhava and then in prema. But even before then, it starts to give its, we can say, its a shadow of its qualities. So we call that the happiness of bhakti manifests. That turns into ananda in bhava, and then intense ananda, sandarananda in prema. So simultaneously, so we get the destruction of suffering and lamentation, and then we get the gradual increase of qualities and bliss. So both are there. In the spiritual world, of course, then there is no material world, there is no sukha, etc. So it's only the positive part which is there. As long as we're in the material world, we're aware of this other aspect. Spiritual world, they're no longer aware of karma and suffering and all that. So only the positive aspect is there in the relationship with the Lord. But we're in the material world, then we do have this other aspect. So that's why it is mentioned here. So the kings, therefore, rightly desire to surrender to the Lord. That is the only way to solve the situation of the material world. So in that aspect, they are completely correct. Not only they surrender to the Lord, but they surrender to Krishna, who is Swayam Bhagavan, the ultimate form of the Lord. So there's some advantage here. Not only is the Supreme Lord, but the special form of the Lord, that is Krishna, who manifests extra qualities. So, of course, this is Krishna in his Dwarka form, where he's only Purna, not the Vrindavan form where he is Purnatama. So the qualities manifest to a little bit lesser degree. But even in Dwarka, still, these qualities manifest. Krishna has special devotees and special pastimes and special form, which is very sweet compared to the other forms of the Lord. So manifest to some degree also in Dwarka. So, therefore, the reward for their surrender is that they also are going to get not only destruction and suffering, but the bliss, the special bliss of a relationship with Krishna. So, you can say, great coincidence or whatever, by very good fortune, they get this opportunity to interact with the Supreme Lord. And get his mercy, and therefore they can they get a higher type of realization than with any form of the Lord. Okay, any question there?
Living in peace in the spiritual world, he's not aware of the material world, the existence of a material world, the spiritual problems.
Why would he be? He's only aware of Krishna. He hasn't got a material body. He's only dedicated to Krishna. He has prema. So therefore, his whole life centers around how to make Krishna happy. That's all. So then why would he think of anything else?
Knowing he's elevated from the material world.
Well, if we're mukta, we get siddha, sadhana siddhas. If we're sadhana siddhas, yes. But then everything is gone. The ahankara is gone. Avidya is gone. All attachments are gone. So then why would we think of the material world? Because we think of the material world because we're attached to something here. What if you have prema? Zero. Zero attachment. So it's a zero thought. Yeah, because it's like everything increases gradually. Bhakti is obviously there in the beginning, a seed of bhakti, and it grows as the thing, and then it turns into a flower and then a fruit. So the flower is the bhava, and the fruit is the prema. So in one sense, they look quite different, but actually they're all part of the same plant, and one is a progression on the other. So, you'll find the ananda in bhava because there's a direct perception of the Lord, direct service to the Lord, and we can see the Lord, so we develop spiritual eyes and spiritual body to some degree. And then it matures in prema when all anarthas are gone and rasa manifests in this full form. And so we get sandarananda at that stage. So then, what happens before then? Is it just suddenly that happiness appears and pure bhakti or bhava appears? Of course, that's kind of described like that when it describes the bhakti, that it manifests, it simply manifests in the heart in bhava stage. But obviously, it started from the seed and then it manifested into the flower and then it goes into the fruit. So it's the bhakti is always there in some form. We may not call it bhava and then prema. Now, the bhava refers to the sthayi bhava, so one establishes one's relationship. It doesn't suddenly appear because we're cultivating it all along. And according to how we cultivate, the sthayi bhava manifests as shanta, dasya, sakya, or madhurya bhava in the sthayi bhava, in the bhava stage. So it doesn't just come from nowhere. It's gradually through our sadhana it manifests. So we can say it's there, that the ananda that comes from that sthayi bhava, it must be there in some way, but we don't call it ananda, we don't call it sthayi bhava when it's in the beginning stages, because the bhakti is small and the anarthas are a lot. So therefore, which Krishna doesn't manifest himself directly, and we could say the experience we get is much covered over because of our anarthas and the smallness of the attraction we have. But we can see even the sakti stage that it's described, Vishnu Chakravarti describes it, in a sakti stage then one gets one doesn't see Krishna directly, but one gets a reflection of Krishna in the heart. So it's approaching that. So it's, Krishna's becoming a little more manifest as we go on. So it's not that it's completely zero before Bhavan suddenly appears. It's like a gradual manifestation there also. As anartas go and the devotion becomes stronger, then, you know, our experience of Krishna is becoming more and more until it finally manifests as an actual vision of Krishna and Bhava. So we can say the bliss of bhakti is there. It's called sukha, bhakti sukha, in the beginning stages, just to distinguish it from the ananda of bhava and prema.
If you couldn't call it Sai Baba until Baba.
Yeah.
So, and yet there is a Raga Sadhana that takes place before Baba.
Yeah.
And the Raga Sadhana is dependent.
So you mean Raganuga you're talking about? Hmm? Raganuga?
Yeah, it's only executed if one has some inkling of the Sai Baba, otherwise there's no meaning.
Yeah. You have an attraction for a certain Sai Baba.
It executes it.
Yeah.
Make any sense.
Yeah.
So if you don't call that Sai Baba,
it's a sadhana for the Sthayi Bhava. I don't think so, no. This sadhana. So we engage the senses with a particular aspiration for following after a certain inhabitant of Vrindavan. So we choose that because of our attraction. I don't know what we call that, but that's usually due to influence of another devotee who has such an attraction also, that we get influenced and we develop. So just as we worship Krishna because we get influenced by devotees who worship Krishna. Other people get to worship Vishnu and Sri Sampradaya because they get influenced by them. So with that inclination is before, I don't know if there's a particular name for it, but it's usually due to association.
So, how is connected to mercy and the devotion here? Mercy and devotion.
So we know that the Lord is not particularly attached to karma, jnana, dhyana, all these different things, as He is to bhakti. Therefore, He's not really attracted to the practice of jnana or karma or yoga. But actually within these, there is prescriptions for worship of the Lord. In Karma Yoga, also worship of Vishnu. Or in Jnana, if they do it properly, they're not Mayavadis, they don't offend the Lord. And they also do worship of Vishnu, understanding that He's the giver of liberation. Or in Yoga, they worship Paramatma without any offense. So that's their bhakti. It's not a large amount of bhakti because their aspiration is liberation. They respect the Lord and understand He's the giver of liberation. So they do that. A little bit of bhakti. So that is the where they get the mercy from. And then He gives them liberation. Why would the Lord give liberation? Because it's nothing for the Lord. And even for the devotees, it's nothing. It's insignificant. So yeah, He's given a little bit of bhakti. Give them liberation. Just like we say, Namabhas gives liberation. Huh? Shadow chanting of the name. A dim, what is it like, the before the sunrise, like that. That type of influence of the holy name, even accidental chanting, can give liberation. Because it's insignificant for the Lord to do so. He doesn't care for it either. So, Gyanis, they do a little bhakti for the Lord. Paramatma yogis meditate a little on the Lord. And so, okay. He gives them that. Yeah.
So how to understand this? Even sometimes devotees also experience suffering. Even sometimes devotees relate them, I think I was better than before.
Yeah, because it's not immediate in most cases. Gradual. The whole anartha nivritti takes place in a scale from, faith we start, and the whole process starts. So it's not that suddenly we begin practicing bhakti and have sadhusanga, then all the anarthas are gone. Gradually. And even in bhava, little anartha is there. And in prema, zero anartha. So So a gradual extinction of the anartas.
Can you say until one reaches this pleasure to continue with him?
Yeah. Yeah. And even in prema, there will be klesha, but the klesha is different. It's not actually karma anymore. And it's not due to fault of the devotee. It is simply a shadow of karma that is, produced by the Supreme Lord. So that even the prem bhaktas have a body, which is karma. And they go through incidents. They may get sick or have an accident or whatnot. So like a pattern of karma goes on even for the prem bhakta. Technically, all karmas are destroyed. And, Yamaraj can't touch them or nothing can happen. But the Lord preserves a little pattern of karma even for the prem bhakta.
But
we do get descriptions of the face, so many descriptions of the face. The gopis are describing his lips, his flute, his eyes, his smile, his locks of hair, his earrings, his cheeks. So many, descriptions are there. So it's obvious that, they're not just looking at his feet all the time. They're also looking at his face. Yeah, so I'm saying because that's the initial process of bhakti, that we start with that surrender, and from there then we do the processes of bhakti, etc. But when we do the, even like in archana, then we have the whole form of the Lord there, and we don't just worship the feet and see the worship all the Lord in this whole form.
In the context of the living entities in the spiritual world not being aware of the material world, what is the aspect of those living entities?
Oh, well, he's of course Shaktivesh avatar of the Lord. He has special position, just like the Supreme Lord. You can say in the spiritual world, he's not really aware of the material world, but he has his expansions like Karnodakshaya Vishnu. They are definitely aware of the material world. Kshirodakshaya Vishnu, they witness all the activities of the jiva. At the simultaneously, Krishna is completely unaware when he's having pastimes in Vrindavan. Nothing to do with the material world at all. That's why we describe it in terms of his amsa's expansions, doing the role, because he separates himself from the aspect. At the same time, he's one. So simultaneously, he knows and he doesn't know. We can say the devotees also can be like that in one sense, like Narada Muni knows and doesn't know, so he's in the bliss of prema at the same time. Then, he's preaching in the material world and observes things in the material world.